My name's Guy Harrison. I'm an Australian who works for a company based in Austin, Texas. So, g'day y'all. And you can tell this is a big data presentation because we've got a picture of a person looking very perplexed, doing nothing, just staring at a computer. But this presentation is on Oracle, Hadoop, and the big data revolution. I'll just introduce myself briefly. I've been working with Oracle since I look like this. I don't know why you're laughing, right? It's the glasses, right? But I'll have you know that in this time, 1988, this was actually a bit of a status symbol. Here's Bill Gates around the same time. And here's Michael Bell, the head of Bell at that point. So those big glasses are actually a sign of great things to come, not the sort of like nerdy thing that you thought it was. I worked as an Oracle developer and DBA, and Firebase and a bit of SQL Server as well for 25 years now. I wrote a few books on Oracle, one on MySQL with Stephen Feuerstein. That's my most recent book. It's an 11G performance book. I'm an Oracle ace, and you can contact me on the web. I have a website, guyharrison.net, where it's blogs and articles and things like that, links to talks. You can email me here. That's my work email address. You can get me on Google Plus here. Google Plus is really hotting up, actually, for Oracle discussions, so if you're not on yet, you might want to get on. And hit Twitter, I'm Guy Harrison. And like everyone who's on Twitter, I really like to be mentioned, so if you do enjoy the talk, feel free to mention it. If you didn't enjoy the talk, then I won't mind if you don't actually say that. So in previous years, if you've seen me before, I came into Dell as part of Quest Software. Quest is a systems management vendor. We had stuff for Windows, virtualization, systems management, so forth. But we're best known in this community, or we were best known in this community for Toad, which is an IDE for database development and administration, mainly for Oracle. We had a lot of fun with Toad over the years. You know, it's a well-known brand. You can see around about 2010 we started extending Toad away from the traditional databases into the, what we now call big data sets, Hadoop, NoSQL, that sort of thing. And today Toad has support for an enormous variety of different sorts of data, including all the big data technologies that we know of. We've got millions of Toad users. Toad users love Toad. Very popular all around the world, in all sorts of demographics. Come on, Mr. Obama, wave. Wow. Okay, and of course, Michael Dell last year, his love of Toad extended to buying the company. And seriously though, if you've been a Toad user for many years, you might be wondering whether, what does it mean that Dell now owns Toad? Well, Toad couldn't have found a better place to land than in Dell. Dell's invested, increased the investment in R&D. I lead the development for all of the information management products, including Toad. The investment is increasing, and you're going to see a lot of exciting things come out of Toad in all arenas. So in any talk like this, we always there's always a slide that says, what is big data? And as often as not, the answer is there is it's something to do with three or four Vs. So the three Vs are volume, we've gone up from terabytes, petabytes, exabytes, zettabytes. Variety, the data's gone from being sort of typical structured data to unstructured data, human-generated, machine-generated. And velocity, which is just the rate at which data is being generated. And the fourth V, this is a sort of a Gartner definition, the fourth V is value. We see more in the data than we did in the past. So the three or four Vs, they're fine. Obviously, volumes have always been increasing. I've been at Open World 15 times now, and in half the presentations I've ever given, there's been some slide like this that says, wow, data's getting bigger. And so for us, database professionals, it doesn't seem like big data, so what? We've always had exponential growth. Although the volume is now getting to the point at which it seems mind-boggling. So the human brain is apparently got about 2.8 petabytes of information in it. Google exceeded that many years ago. All of the genetic material in every human being on Earth comes to 5.5 exabytes. That is about half an exabyte. We've generated that much going back 5 years. And now the total digital capacity that we're generating pretty much exceeds the capacity of all of the information stored in every human brain and way exceeds the information of all the genetic material. So it way exceeds in a way all the information on Earth that existed beforehand. So that's fine. We sort of know that. And we know, the velocity is increasing. Sites like Twitter have seen exponential growth in social media traffic. So we come to this thing about variety, and variety is more key in my mind to it. In fact, I don't really go with 3 Bs when I'm thinking about big data. I don't even like the term big data for that much, but I really like the term coined by O'Reilly called the Industrial Revolution of Data, because this evokes something more to me. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, all products were made by hand. And after the Industrial Revolution, products were mass-produced by factories. And in a similar way, before the Industrial Revolution of Data, all the data was entered by hand internally to the company. You know, people were paid just to type data in. But now, of course, we know that data is coming in from all sorts of sources, from your customers, through social media. There's a whole new generation of mobile users coming along. We're wiring up our houses. This is sort of just beginning now, but most of in the next couple of years, we'll see thermostats and other things within the house connected to the internet. We're wiring up ourselves. We're wearing sort of devices that connect to the internet and generate data, smartwatches and so forth. Google Glass is a good example, and we'll come back to that. And we're wiring up cars. Most cars now have some sort of data connection, most new cars anyway. And the streets are getting wired up. And everywhere we go and everywhere we do, data is being generated and collected. So if we look at data in the past, say 20 years ago, for a business or our society, data was generated internally to the organisation, and it was pretty much about efficiency, you know, like how do we sort of like reduce our supply chain or optimise our spend on labour or what have you. But now in today's world, it's generated mainly externally. It's the key to competitiveness rather than to efficiency. It's creating a whole bunch of new products that are really products, you know, that exist only in the sense that they generate and create data, and it's literally changing our world. Another way to have a look, to think about this that I really like is to think of big data as really being just a sort of a buzzword that encapsulates the major trends that we've seen over the past 10, 15 years. So 15 years ago, if you wanted to buy a product, you'd get your shopping trolley, well, shopping trolley would be there, and you'd go to the store. Neat animation, huh? I was pretty proud of that. And then it was 15 years ago or so, you know, towards the end of the last century, that stores moved into the cloud, right? All stores had some sort of web presence, and pretty much all stores that you buy online. But people didn't really buy online because, you know, for the average person, the computer was in the den or the study or something, and they didn't have it with them all the time. People like us probably were online all the time, but the average consumer was not. But then social media came along, things like, well, Facebook in particular, and that put all of the average consumers online, gave them an identity in the cloud, if you like. And that still didn't really create the revolution until the smartphone. Because once the smartphone came along, the connection between the cloud that your identity was in and the cloud in which the businesses were in, that connection became persistent at all times. And if you know this, right, everyone who's on Facebook is using their phone all the time to update their status and see what their friends are doing. Meanwhile, they can also use their phone to buy objects or shop around. And businesses are looking to social media to get ideas about trends and so forth. And they're posting to social media to try and influence their customers. And really, the physical store is really far less important than it used to be. It's this kind of like cycle in the cloud between mobile, e-commerce and social that's really creating the big data, and it's really requires the big data to succeed. And this cycle is just speeding up all the time, and that to me is the essence of what's creating what we now call big data. But it's not all good news for us or for businesses. I mean, big data can really be deadly. That picture, by the way, comes from that movie Sharknado, where there's a tornado that sucks sharks out of the Pacific and dumps them in Los Angeles. That looks like a good movie, I haven't seen it, but it could be okay. So deadly in what way? Well, let's think about retail. If I was a retailer at the moment, I would be incredibly fearful of the future. So what's this woman doing? She's scanning a barcode with her phone, and she'll look up online and she'll find the price in other stores. So she'll come into the store, scan for the price, and then go and buy it somewhere else. And I bet you've all done this, right? At some point you've gone into a store, saw some object you liked, and gone and bought it online. In fact, Gartner did a study earlier this year in which almost 60% of consumer electronics buyers admitted to doing this, and well over 50% of home improvement buyers did it as well. So that's people who are buying couches and things like that. And so that's pretty scary if you retail, but at least if you're selling couches, you think people have to come in and sit down on the couch and sort of look at the couch before they buy it. Not really, right? In the new world, it looks like augmented reality systems like this will allow you just to hold your iPad up in your living room and think, what would this couch look like here? Now, it can't really simulate the experience of sitting on the couch, maybe, so you know there's still some tie into the store, but this sort of phenomenon is still pretty scary, and there's other things coming up for buying clothes, for instance. This is an Xbox system with the Kinect. It can sense your shape and your movements, and it's sort of like you can simulate by putting on various garments and what will they look like when I dance and things like that. Even stores are starting to change in many ways. This is Kate Spade. This is not a store that you can walk into. You just walk up to this storefront and that screen on the right, you tap it and you can buy it online, essentially, you know, as you're walking down the street. So why is all this happening? Why are consumers sort of doing showrooming and buying online? Well, there's a couple of really sort of fairly obvious reasons. The selection online can be larger. Typical stores are often out of stock of what you want. It's faster, and you know, to buy from a computer at your house than to walk down the street. And it's often cheaper. And the responses for retail are all around big data. So what can they do? Dynamically price items. Predictive ordering. Order things that you think people are going to want before they arrive in the store. Also predict what sort of like assortments they want, what sort of like combinations of items are effective. Predictive recommendation systems that reach out to you and suggest that you buy something, and personalisation. And they're all effectively big data solutions if you think about it, or at least they're data and algorithmic solutions. So here's some of the things that sort of like the advanced wave of retail are doing. This is ShopKick. It's a defence for showrooms. What happens with ShopKick is you can go into a store and scan a barcode, and if you then go off and buy the product online, the store gets a kickback. They effectively get paid for being the showroom, even if the person doesn't buy it in the store. Neiman Marcus has a system where before you go to the store, you can go on your phone and say, I'm coming in, and they'll get an associate ready to greet you at the door. They know your size, he'll have the clothes that you might want to wear, and it will sort of like personalise and expedite the service. And Hoynta in Seattle has gone one step further. When you go on the phone, when you say you're coming in, an automated warehouse picks up jeans, brings them into a fitting room. You walk into the fitting room, you try on the jeans. If you like them, you click on your phone, they order them. You might say, I like these jeans, they fit, but I want them in black, and then they ship them to your house. So it's all sort of changing pretty quickly. Here's one other thing that's happening in retail. We'll get off retail in a minute. This isn't a retail presentation, but web analytics for retail. So you know that when people buy online, everyone is sort of tracking the clicks, you know, what did you look at before you bought this? If you say to Amazon, you know, people who bought this also looked at this other product. And physical retailers haven't had this, but they're starting to develop technologies that will do it. So they're going to track you while you're in the store, and they're going to look at what you pick up and what you put down, you know, how you walk through the store, tracking, you know, where, you know, the best parts of the aisle are and so forth. It's kind of creepy, right? But it's a pretty obvious thing for them to do. And so all stores are going to be sort of like, in a way, the physical store, not just the e-store, is going to be a generator and a consumer of big data in the same way. So in retail, and I will get off retail in a second, there's what I think of now as the first mover advantage. The only way to really succeed is to be the first company or the first business to offer the product to the consumer. The first person to send me an email about a new gadget that I might want to buy, they're most likely to get the sale. The old model of actually sort of pretty much putting a table and dropping all your stuff on it and hoping someone walks in the room where you've got the table and just picks up the thing they want, that's kind of gone. You know, it's just not going to, that sort of model is not going to survive. And only big data analytics can really sort of provide this sort of first mover advantage. And in every industry, there's some sort of similar story. I'm just using retail as an example because it's something that we're all sort of familiar with and that we can all relate to. But really, in the work that we're doing, we see that every industry, pretty much without exception, can see that the key to their competitiveness or the key to their effectiveness is got to do with data and algorithms, and that effectively means big data. So the revolution's not over yet either. You know, the technologies haven't stopped. Now, I took this photo at Google I.O., which was in this building, actually, earlier this year. And this is when I discovered what sick with envy was. Because I would see the people who'd got the Google Glass through the contest and from the previous year, and I would feel ill in my stomach because I wanted the Google Glass so much. But I've gotten over that now because they've published a teardown of Google Glass showing what all of the componentry is. So I've been able to build my own Google Glass equivalent. It's a bit of a work in progress, but it's going to be better than Google Glass, I can tell you that much, because it's going to have face recognition. And Google says they won't do face recognition, it's creepy, but I think it's essential. So you imagine if you're in some sort of like industry like you know, hospitality or something, and maybe you're a bit confused and you might have had a concussion or something, who knows. And a customer comes in and you want to sort of serve them well. If you had your Google Glasses, Google could do face recognition, could tell you something about the customer, some important facts, and give you advice about how to deal with them. And it will probably go beyond that in our lifetimes. And here's the serious side of this, right? If we've got Google Glass and we're walking into a store, we pick up a book, scans the barcode, tells you where else you can get the book. Maybe you can just say buy online, just sort of mumble something to Google Glass, and there you go. You've walked into the store, gone and bought with someone else with almost no friction whatsoever. It would be easier to do that than to take the book that was in your hand and go to the cashier. So it's still sort of fairly scary. And we'll sort of see these technologies in three. They may or may not have, you know, contact lenses that can give you a heads-up display, although on Futurama, Fry, who's in the future, went to get an iPhone, asked the guy, you know, why do you call it an iPhone? He said, well, wait till I install it, you'll see why. There it goes. And now he's got this great heads-up display, and the guy's just about to install the earpiece. Ultimately, you know, the heads-up display and all that is just one step on the way to sort of ultimate interface, which would be brain control. So this sounds like a sort of a wacky science fiction idea, and you might think I'm still joking, but not really, because getting the data out of the brain is not that difficult. We know how to do it, or we know how it's generated. The brain generates electromagnetic fields. We pretty much can measure them with, you know, big hats. But we can sort of tell what people are thinking to a certain degree now. And so there's a bunch of sort of head-based interfaces that are going to pick up brainwaves and try and use them for controls. Now these are sort of a bit dubious because it takes a lot of training for you to, with your mind, learn how to control things. But the sort of reading of brain state is a lot easier. This is a thing that's coming out later this year called Muse, and it doesn't try and be a control device. It just tries to get your feelings and your state. Are you paying attention? Are you happy? Are you sad? Are you scared? Are you lonely? And by doing this, they're going to do things like select a playlist on your phone that gets you out of your doldrums, for instance. If you're watching a video and you're not paying attention, maybe it'll automatically pause. There's a million sort of applications for this sort of stuff. Here's one that came up at Comic-Con last year. This girl's wearing a hat that measures her mental state and sort of posts her state to a sort of a Facebook-type map program. So as she's walking through the world, she's sort of like, you know, if she's happy, you know, that's map. If she's sad, that's map. If she's scared, that's map. So imagine if we all had this as we were walking through San Francisco at Open World. The really buzzy places of San Francisco would be mapped and we'd go to them, and the sort of scary neighbourhoods would be sort of like, you know, red, and you'd know not to go to there. Now this is one gadget that I couldn't go with. It just goes a bit far for me because it's also got a tail that will wag when you're happy. So I don't think I'd do that. I'll do a lot, but you know, maybe not that. That's a bridge too far. But so you think about how we will be, just as a human beings, how we will be instrumented up to the big data world. I expect this to be, you know, in my future relatively soon, that the phone is kind of like a hub. It's like a router that's connecting you to the wide area network and providing a sort of a Bluetooth local area network and GPS positioning, all the things that the phone does now, really effectively. And on your wrist, you'd have something that would be measuring your pulse and respiration, and, you know, if you had a heart attack or something, it would, you know, send for the EMTs or what have you, and also measuring your health and things like that and giving you sort of alarms. And on your head, you will probably have something that will do voice, you know, speak to you, listen to you, maybe give heads-up display, and maybe even be reading brainwaves. And when that all happens and the world is all plugged in like this, what we call now big data is going to accelerate even further. So that's my kind of plug for big data as its significance in society. And it will accelerate this sort of like feedback loop that we were talking about before. So let's get technical then and talk about what sort of technologies are actually, you know, interesting to us as sort of database people. I gather, you know, a lot of you will be database people or Oracle professionals anyway. So the first company to really face up to all of this was Google. You know, Google were the pioneers of big data because right from the start, Google were dealing with data that, whose velocity was increasing at an exponential rate and which was already too big for any sort of like database technology that we had available to us. So when Google started, they just put sort of like a bunch of servers under a table, as you would, but pretty soon they were working with RAS. So the first picture is maybe 96, 97 and the second picture is 2000. And you can see just at the bottom right there that their air conditioning system was just a little bit too weak for those racks. But now Google's unit of processing power is a shipping container full of servers with its own power supply and cooling and so forth. And they bring in these shipping containers and they're full of servers like this and the servers can fail at any moment and someone will just come and pull this failed one out and slot a new one in. And then they'll rack these things up, what we think of as racks of servers. You know, they've got racks of shipping containers and there are literally millions of servers in shipping containers like this in Google data centers around the world. Now I think we can sort of see that Google couldn't have used Oracle Rack like, or anything like the technologies that we've been used to in the relational database world to do this. So they had to build their own software architecture to go with that hardware architecture. And what they did is they took all of these servers, each of which had their own disks inside them, right? There was no SAN, it was just direct attached disk, and built a file system that allowed all of that to be exposed as if it was just one file system. And then on top of that, they built some processing algorithms, database algorithms, and built their applications on them. Now one of the key algorithms, I'm sure you've heard of it, is MapReduce, which is pretty simple conceptually. It's just an algorithm for breaking up a problem into little chunks that can be distributed across on all these servers. And the reduce phase is just pulling all those chunks back to giving an answer. And when you have a complicated MapReduce phase, you'll have multiple mappers and reducers, and there'll be a shuffle of data going backwards and forwards out to the answer. Now, if that looks familiar to the database people, you know, this is pretty much the sort of Oracle parallel query, you know, scan, sort, group by. And, you know, MapReduce can look like that. It can also look a lot more complicated. But it's not conceptually that much different from Oracle parallel query, except at the scale. We're not talking about 256 nodes. We're talking about potentially thousands or, well, tens of thousands in Google's case, nodes involved. Another thing about Google's architecture was that it was schemaless, or at least it was deferred schema. So we know, again, you know, if you've worked in the database industry, you've probably done ETL projects where you take the data, you extract it out of files, you clean it, you sort of work out what its structure is, you normalize it, and that's called ETL, extract, transform, and load into a relational database. And then by the time you've gone through this ETL process, the design and so forth, it's probably 6 to 12 months, and you're providing data which is already sort of like out of date from the point of view of the industry. Now what Google's architecture allowed them to do was just dump all the web data just into the directly into this file system. That's a dupe there, but it probably should be Google. And although you still need to know what it looks like when you read it, that phase is at least delayed and somewhat reduced. And since a lot of the stuff you're dumping in, you may never need to know, you may never use it, you can dump everything in and you only use what you want, and that brings the cycle in closer. And that's the difference between schema on write, knowing what the schema is when you put it in the data space, to schema on read, where you only need to know what it looks like when you pull it out. So, Hadoop event, which is, you know, one of the key big data technologies, is effectively an open source implementation of the Google architecture. And this open source architecture, this open source implementation was proven at scale many years ago at Yahoo. So even back in, I guess, 2009, Yahoo had, or 2008, Yahoo took Hadoop and used it for their online system. And you know, Yahoo's are similar to Google in many, many respects. They index the web and so forth. So they used Hadoop to run their business at scale, you know, and their Hadoop cluster was, at least at this point, 4,000 nodes with 16 petabytes of disk, 64 terabytes of RAM, 32,000 cores, all of which could be put to a single job if necessary. Now, at the moment, I've been struggling to find out where Yahoo is with their new Hadoop clusters, because the 4,000 limit was kind of like part of the old architecture. They are trying to get to 10,000 node clusters. I don't know where they are now, but certainly this is something that was established, you know, probably 3 years ago at least. And since the implementation at Yahoo, almost every web company, almost every startup, almost every financial company, almost every social networking company has adopted Hadoop in some form or another. And now it's sort of like a Fortune 500. It would be kind of unusual to come to one of those companies and say, have you got a Hadoop project, and find out they didn't have any at all. They're still sort of in pilot, a lot of them, but they're all there. Now, that having been said, it's definitely true that Yahoo still has the biggest Hadoop cluster, maybe followed by Facebook and LinkedIn. Most Hadoop clusters out in the wild are not as big as Yahoo's, but the Yahoo example at least proves that the technology is scalable. That's a sort of like, that map was put up by this guy at Hadoop Wizard based on the published size of nodes. So the size of Yahoo indicates the size of their cluster. Although Facebook has a cluster equally as big, I'm led to believe. Okay, so Hadoop, similar architecture to Google, obviously, since that's exactly what it was attempting to do. You take all of the nodes in the cluster with their directly attached disk, you create a file system on top, the Hadoop distributed file system, which allows all of those files to be accessed from a standard file system API. And you use MapReduce and Yarn, which I'll get to in a minute. There's sort of a coordinating system, and there's other technologies and a database. And then you've got a bunch of utilities that didn't come out of Google: Hive, Pig, Scoop, and Flume. And we'll talk about what they all do, but they're important technologies for anyone who's going to do something serious with Hadoop. And on top of that, there's a workflow manager called Oozie. And this is grossly simplified. Cloudera or Hortonworks will give you a diagram in which there are sort of like 100 boxes, but these are the ones that sort of matter most to me. So let's look at the Hadoop architecture. You know, I don't want to sort of dive into this in sort of huge detail, but it's interesting to have a look at how it works at a sort of like a high level abstraction. So you have racks of computers, and each of these computers, most of them are a data node and task tracker, which is to say they can process a MapReduce job, and they can store some data on the disks on them. And then you have some special nodes, the name node, which is the node which knows where all the data is, and a secondary name node, which sounds like it'd be a backup, but actually it isn't. So just don't think that you don't have to protect your name node, because a secondary name node won't function without the name node. There's a very funny Downfall parody where Hitler discovers that the secondary name node is not a backup and goes mad, you know, that you can find if you're interested. It gave me a sort of a giggle, as all of those parodies do. So HDFS effectively, the interface to HDFS has to talk to the name node to find the data, and you know, that's straightforward enough, right? Then there's a job tracker, which is responsible for submitting MapReduce jobs on the cluster. And obviously, MapReduce jobs come into the job tracker, which has to work against HDFS and submits the jobs to the task trackers as well. And in Hadoop version 1, every client, whether it's Java client or one of these other things like Hive and Pig and so forth, they're effectively generating MapReduce Java code that works off this framework. And you can obviously add more nodes to the cluster. You know, it'll grow as far as you want it to. And every piece of data is backed up at least 3 times by default, and typically backed up on different racks. So even if the whole rack goes down, the cluster will continue to process fine. Now, Hadoop 2.0, which is called YARN, which stands for Yet Another Resource Negotiator, which is like a useless acronym probably, it doesn't really tell us that much, is somewhat different. The difference is somewhat nuanced, but it has a resource manager node, and each node is now got a node manager and a container. And the resource manager is kind of like Oracle resource management. It sort of like knows what CPU and what I.O. is going on in these nodes. And the container is where the jobs run. And when you get a new job, it goes to the resource manager, says, I want to run a job. The resource manager says, fine, I'll start you a job manager on a particular node that's not busy. And then that node will call out to other nodes to run a job. And the advantage of this is that you can run more jobs at once, because in the old model, jobs would sort of collide with each other. There was no coordination of resources. But in this model, two jobs can sort of like be allocated a sort of a fair share of processing capability. So it allows the cluster to get bigger and do more things simultaneously. But the other thing that it does is it allows non-MapReduce workloads to run. So TES, which is a new alternative to MapReduce, which is Hindi for fast, is an example of this. And it's particularly good for example for SQL processing. So in HDFS or in Hadoop, when we want to do something that looks like a SQL statement, we have these map jobs and they reduce and then they feed into each other. And it works, but it's a bit inefficient. One reason it's inefficient is you've got to have multiple jobs typically. Another reason is you have these dummy mapping phases which are just there to hook the jobs together. And in TES, instead you just run it more logically as a sort of like a single entity. It can all run in the same job. It has less steps. And so if you think about a complicated execution plan for an SQL statement, TES is a lot better at running those sorts of workloads than MapReduce would be. Or so they claim anyway, so I can't say this from personal experience, but they've got benchmarks that demonstrate this pretty convincingly. And this sort of thing is called a directed acyclic graph, if you ever sort of come across someone saying it's running a DAG. That just means it's running a sort of a complicated graph processing within the one job. So other things in Hadoop, and we'll move through these pretty fast, but they're important components. HBase is a database built on Hadoop. Now what does that mean? Well, if you think about Oracle, Oracle's a database built on a file system. You have disks and you take all of those disks and you create some sort of file system on it. Most of the time now we use ASM, but in the past, you know, we'd use Unix file systems or something like that. And then on the file system you create data files, which you have, you know, and redo files, and then you have table spaces and tables, and you have some memory to cache it to and so forth. And that's sort of like, you know, simplified Oracle architecture. And HBase in that, from that perspective, isn't that different. You have your disks, they are turned into a file system by HDFS, and then you create your HBase files and they have a log, you know, a transaction log, a sort of like a redo log in a way, and they have files in which you store things that are called tables and you have a memory buffer and so forth. Now, there are some significant differences, but this is a fair enough approximation. HBase is built on HDFS the way that Oracle is built on ASM. But inside HBase, the data model, it's way different. So if you think about data models in relational databases, so here's some data, like people visiting websites, and Jane and Dick visit eBay and Google and Facebook and I Love Larry and things like that. And if we were going to model that, you know, we all know how to do that, right? We'd create three tables. We'd create a person table, a website table, and a join table with foreign keys out there for the people and the websites. And then that's how we'd store that. In HBase, it's not like that at all. We would create one row for each person and we'd store all of the sites they visited as columns. Now, as an Oracle person, you're saying, hang on, you can't do that because they might have visited 10,000, 100,000 websites. Yep, you can have 10,000, 100,000 columns. And then you'd say, but wait a minute, but they don't all visit the same websites, you know, and that's right, they don't all have to have the same columns. The column names can be different for different people. So here, Jane did not go to Mad Bill fans, and Dick did not go to I Love Larry, so they don't have those columns in their records. So it's a very, very different data model and it requires sort of like different ways of programming and so forth. Now Hive is something that is database people, if we are familiar with database and SQL, we're going to find the most easy way to get into Hadoop. So Hive works against the problem that MapReduce is hard. Now this isn't Hadoop MapReduce, this is MongoDB MapReduce, which is a lot easier than Hadoop MapReduce. But you can see on the left there's an SQL statement, on the right, here's how you do the same thing in Mongo MapReduce. And I think you sort of look at that for a bit, you'll go, wow, I don't think I could just write that the way I can just write an SQL statement. Even when I'm really good, I don't want to write, you know, that page of code. But it's actually worse in that would probably be this much code in Java. You know, if you want to sort of like do just a simple SQL statement that joined and grouped by and so forth, that's what you'd have to write. So Hive gets around that. What Hive does is take someone like me who wants to write an SQL. I send an SQL statement. It's actually called HQL, HiveQL, but it's SQL. and I send it to Hive. Hive compiles that to Java code, which runs MapReduce and returns the results to me. So I get a pretty familiar sort of C++ style interface to Hadoop, and that's the way, pretty much almost the only way I've ever used Hadoop, really, because that's, you know, I'm not going to learn how to write all that MapReduce Java code. There's a bunch of SQL-like languages to Hadoop. Everybody's been developing them over the past couple of years. Cloudera's got an alternative to Hive called Impala. A bunch of people from Oracle worked on that, including Greg Rain, if you know him. He was in the Oracle Exadata Data Warehousing Group. So, you know, there's smart SQL types working on that. MapR has one, Aster and GreenThumb have one. Hadapt is an alternative, sort of like a different approach altogether. And then Oracle has a kind of way in which, from within Oracle, you can take a HDFS file and use it as an external table, and then you can run SQL. And actually, Oracle has a couple of different ways you can do this from within Oracle. Not that I'd really recommend them if you're going straight to Hadoop. It's really sort of overkill to have an Oracle database and sort of the SQL sort of like running out of Oracle into Hadoop, but it is a possibility. Another way to simplify your life with Hadoop is to use Pig. And Pig is a sort of a scripting language. I sometimes say it's like Perl for Hadoop. That's not really accurate, but it gives you an idea. So where this would be your SQL or your HiveQL, this would be your Pig script. Now, I don't have time to go through how Pig works, but the best way, if you're experienced with SQL programming, to understand it is you essentially write the execution plan directly. So if you imagine yourself writing an execution plan rather than a SQL statement, then you'll get the hang of Pig. So where we say from, it says, you know, load this table. Where we want a where clause, that's a filter, but that happens after we load the table. And then we do a join, we do the grouping, we do the aggregation. And one thing there that you can see if you look closely is the way you do a group by and the way you do a having clause and a where clause are the same. It's just where they are in the execution plan that makes the difference. So that's the way it is on Oracle too. You know, having and where is just before the group by or after the group by. That's the difference between the two clauses. So it's kind of fun to write Pig, because as someone who's done a lot of SQL tuning work in the past, sometimes all I wanted to do was tell Oracle what to do and get him to do it, and Pig lets you do that. There's no real optimizer. You are the optimizer when you're writing Pig. You can also write much more complicated data flows than you could in an SQL statement. So where you might tie multiple SQL statements together in PLSQL and Oracle, you can just do the whole thing in one long Pig chain. So that's cool. And then the other tools that I mentioned in that sort of architecture layout were Flume and Scoop. So Flume and Scoop are both about getting data into Hadoop. Flume's about getting files in, so web logs, machine-generated data, that would be Flume. And Scoop's about getting relational database information in. So let's say you had the web logs and they had product codes in them. You need to find out what the product codes are, what the product is. Maybe that's in the relational database, so you use Scoop to bring that in. And then once you've got all of that data together, you're in a position to write your MapReduce job. And we've done a lot of work at Dell on Scoop. We've got a Scoop, an open source Scoop plugin that you can use, and as you see towards the end of the presentation, we've got some other stuff as well that helps with that. Okay, so meanwhile, while all this big data and Hadoop stuff was going on, back at Oracle headquarters, Death Star, I took some of the funniest slides out because I thought that maybe Dell branding would like my, I had a picture of Larry as the Emperor with lightning. So if you think that's kind of a bit off the edge. Anyway, so obviously Oracle, you know, as the premier database company in the world, was looking at all this Hadoop stuff and trying to work out what it meant for them. And if you think about the timing, Hadoop was coming around about the same time that Oracle had released Exadata and was having a great time selling Exadata boxes and, you know, promoting them very heavily. And there's no doubt that Exadata has the raw capability for almost everyone, right? I mean, there's enough storage and cores there for most people, right? You can't run Yahoo on it, but you can certainly run, you know, anything that we might be likely to run. So initially, I guess Oracle was thinking that maybe, you know, they would say that you don't need Hadoop, you can use Exadata. problem is with Exadata is just the price point. Aside from anything else, things like schema on write, schema on read, but the price point per terabyte for Exadata is not that appealing when you compare it to open source Hadoop. So list price, that's what the difference is. Now Oracle will discount and so forth, and it's probably not quite that much now. But nevertheless, you can see that if you're starting a big data project and Oracle's coming in and saying, give me $4 million, and you've got some other guy saying, I can do it for $50,000, $500,000, say, you know the temptation is going to be to go for the 500,000. So Oracle at some point I think thought that they needed to have a Hadoop-like technology. So they released the Oracle Big Data Appliance, and this came out 2 years ago, OpenWorld 2 years ago is when it was first announced, and so it's pretty mature now. And if you want to think about it from an Exadata point of view, it's a rack the same size as Exadata, and it's filled up with what you know appear to be Exadata storage cells, only instead of having the cell CLI stuff on it, it's got Hadoop. They're all Hadoop nodes. And they're pretty beefy nodes, right? They've got 12 cores each, 12 2-terabyte hard drives, 48 gigs of RAM, and the networking between the nodes is exceptionally good. It's all InfiniBand, whereas a typical Hadoop cluster would have 10 gigabit Ethernet or maybe even 1 gigabit Ethernet connections. So when you're doing that shuffling between nodes, the Oracle Big Data Appliance can claim, I think, with cores to say we'll be faster at that sort of workload. And it's competitively priced. So you might be thinking, oh yeah, but how much does this cost me? Well, actually, they priced it about the price that you'd assemble a Hadoop cluster for anyway. So it's a serious offering, at a realistic price. And what they put in it, they put in Cloudera Enterprise, which is Cloudera is the biggest or the first and largest distributor of Hadoop software. Now there are a few others like Hortonworks and Intel, but Oracle partnered with Cloudera. They have R, which is an open source machine learning and statistics package. A key value database, think of it a bit like HBase, it's based on Berkeley technologies in there, and big data connectors, which are there to help you move data to and fro from Oracle and so forth. So, worth having a look at. So, last topic that I want to talk about was how you generate competitive advantage. And what are the big data analytic techniques? So far I've sort of said this is what big data is and why it's important to business. Then it's these are the technologies for storing big data. Now I want to sort of whiz through what are the algorithms, what are the basics for the algorithms. Well, so there are three. Machine learning, which are programs that learn from new data, so algorithms that change as new data comes in. Collective intelligence, which are programs that take the inputs of lots and lots of people to draw conclusions. And predictive analytics, which is like extrapolation and predicting, future data from past data. And we might call all of that big data analytics, and sometimes it's called data science. So collective intelligence sounds sort of complex, but we all kind of know what it is. It's like when you type into Google, why is the, and Google comes back with an answer, why is the sky blue? Or apparently, why is the rum gone? And there's some sort of funny things in this. You see, like, where is, comes up with where is Chuck Norris? And you think someone at Google's having a joke, right? Only Bing, someone at Bing is having the same joke, or there are lots of people typing in where is Chuck Norris. You can see some interesting regional differences too. Here in America, when you type in why doesn't, you get a lot of stuff about why doesn't he like me, why doesn't she like me, why doesn't anyone like me, and blah, blah, blah. I type in why doesn't anyone like me to Google all the time. It just never. But here in Australia, actually, what we want to know is why we can't make alcoholic alcohol. It's just the difference, right? And this sort of collective intelligence has been proven to be better. So you think of the spell checker in Microsoft Word, it's been around for 30 years maybe, and it's still, you can type in gibberish into it, and providing every word is okay, they're fine with it. You do that at Google, Google is so confident that you meant something else because it's seen so many other people correct themselves that it doesn't ask you, do you want to correct it, it just corrects it and says, did you really mean that? And similar sorts of techniques are used in recommendation systems. This is my Amazon recommendations. I let my daughter order books, so Amazon thinks I'm a 15-year-old girl who likes vampires and databases. And a serious thing that Google did with this was flu trends. So Google worked out that they could predict when people get sick, they stop typing in why doesn't she like me and start typing in why is my nose runny. And they do that before they go to the doctor. So they get this early indication of flu and they can now sort of like work out where in the world, you know, flu outbreaks are likely to happen. This was yesterday, and this was towards the end of last year when the flu was endemic in the US. And it's really, you know, it's very accurate. Interesting thing about Google flu trends, thing to understand, is they did not sort of say, oh, people will be typing in, why is my nose running? They just took the data of the CDC data of where flu was and then took the web searches and correlated. So they just did this sort of like big data mapping of the two sets and said, who knows what they were, you know, but they didn't sort of like, no one sat down and wrote down the terms. It was like a machine learning algorithm that learned what people type in when they're sick. So collective intelligence seems to outsmart or do better than artificial intelligence. I always wanted to see artificial intelligence like there was in the movie 2001 when I was like 9 years old, this movie came out. It was set in 2001, obviously, and they had big spaceships. We didn't get them, but we did get space shuttles. They had iPads, pretty much. And they had this talking computer that could understand language and really think. And we didn't really get that. This computer, for instance, went mad and killed the astronauts in the end. And I was sort of like wanting something like that. But artificial intelligence really did strike back recently. In 2011, IBM released Watson. And Watson beat is the computer that won at Jeopardy. Now IBM had produced a computer that beat chess a long time ago. We understand chess is sort of brute force. It's not really, you know, nuanced like Jeopardy, where you have to pick a topic and answer a, sort of a weird question like this. And yet this computer was able to beat the world champions at Jeopardy. And I could go into detail about how it works and so forth. But one thing to realise is this was a big data artificial intelligence. It had a Hadoop cluster at the back end and it was massively parallelising the computation that was using machine learning and other techniques. So we talked about collective intelligence, predictive analytics. That's pretty much just, that builds on stuff that we probably all did at school about correlation and regression. You know, get data points and plot a line. That's the foundation for a lot of predictive analytic work. You get more complicated line, you get seasonal adjustments, you get all sorts of things. But it starts with that ability to take some data and write a formula that predicts the data that's going to come out next. And machine learning, which is a bit more of a general topic, and I'll whiz through this really quick because we're coming towards the end of our time. In machine learning, typically supervised machine learning, you take your data, you clean it up, you break it into two sets. You run an algorithm that tries to predict something out of the training set, and then you check the data you put aside and see how good it is. And you just do that over and over again until you get the best model possible, and then that model goes into production. And when new data comes in, like new customers, you use the model to predict what they might like to buy or, you know, something about them that's useful, and you make more money and new business, and then it feeds back there into this virtuous cycle. And this is the work of the data scientists, effectively sort of like generating these models and continually refining them. Unsupervised learning is techniques that are used more like to cluster data. So this is LinkedIn, in maps from LinkedIn. This is my LinkedIn map. And LinkedIn's got this thing where it can sort of like take all your connections and group them. And it does it, it's really quite spooky. So it didn't know what to call these. I had to sort of name them, but it had these sort of like big blue group, big pink group, the orange group and so forth. Turns out the blue group are Oracle people like you, people that I've connected with through my work in the Oracle community. The pink group are people from Quest going back a while. The orange group are more the new Dell people, and there's a sort of a Hadoop group and so forth. And you can sort of see, if you go in deep there, you can see it's kind of, you know, pretty good at working out who someone is and what group they should belong to. Think about that in terms of clustering customers and making recommendations for them. You can see how effective that might be. Okay, and then there's a bunch of, in every sort of like topic, business problem, there's a sort of machine learning solution, or at least a possibly one. But data science is really hard. This stuff is not easy. There's a bunch of open source tooling and commercial tooling. It's particularly difficult for smaller businesses. And there's the sense that, you know, we need more data scientists. So here's my idea of a data scientist, someone who wears the silliest hat possible, right? But there just aren't going to be enough guys like this to satisfy the demand of data science. So what in my R&D group, what we've been doing for the last few years is trying to build up a machine learning platform that can be applied, more widely applied to the broader audience. And we're not alone in doing this. This is where the software industry is working hard to try and make data science easier. And we've got a bunch of other things that Dell to, there's a Toad for Hadoop, just released in beta to the community at that URL. That's particularly designed to help you if you're an Oracle person, you want to get started with Hadoop. You can drag and drop data from Oracle into Hadoop, write some queries, watch them run and so forth. We also have SharePlex for Hadoop, a replication solution for moving data to Hadoop. A bit like Scoop, in fact it does use our Scoop adapter, but it keeps the data up to date at all times. And it will also allow you to capture all changes that occurred to the database in the next release and build up a sort of like a history of them all, kind of like an audit log, but one that you can do for big data mining. And Toad BI, which is our Toad Business Intelligence, is totally compatible with Hadoop and can read data from Hadoop and all other NoSQL sources. And of course, at Dell, we sell hardware too, and we have a hardware package for Hadoop that has the Cloudera or Intel distributions on it. And it's sized, so the Oracle Big Data Appliance, you heard me say that I thought it was a good, potentially a good option, but it's a full rack. If you just want to have a four-node Hadoop cluster, you probably, you know, Dell is as good as anybody at providing that for you, and we'll provide you with the hardware, the software, and, you know, Toad for Hadoop and, you know, all these other products that we're working on. So we aim to be a floor-to-ceiling vendor for Hadoop. Okay, so wrapping up, just two more slides. Firstly, of all of this, what would be my recommendation for businesses? All businesses should be thinking about how data and algorithms transform their business into the future. Those that aren't, a lot of those are probably going to go out of business as they get out-competed by people who've mastered this kind of new world of big data analytics. The technologies that are going to be most important, they're the ones I mentioned. They come to mobility, cloud, Hadoop, analytics. Do you have the data that you need? It probably, for a lot of businesses, it's going to take a couple of years to collect the data you need to make predictions, right? You can't predict off just last week. You probably need years of data before you can make useful predictions. So it makes a lot of sense to start collecting the data you think your big data solution needs right now. Recommendations for individuals in your career. Well, I think, you know, you would have got the impression, I think, that there's a lot of opportunity in Hadoop and other NoSQL databases as well. And that creating a strong demand for DBA and developer type skills, and the demand's going to exceed supply for as long as we can see. So the Oracle market is big and still very, very rich, but if you're looking for somewhere else to diversify, I can tell you a lot of people from that I know that were Oracle specialists, I see them at the Hadoop conferences, so I think it's a sensible move. There's a lot of opportunities for those who understand statistics and math and algorithms. If you did a lot of stats at college and haven't used it for the past 5 years, it might be time to take that knowledge, brush it off, buy a machine learning textbook, and see if you can be the guy with the funny hat that comes to the ABA of the business. And it's pretty easy to get started with Hadoop, actually. You can just download Hadoop, you can install it on a Linux system, you can use Hive and Pig, you can use Toad for Hadoop and so forth. Play around with it, get into it. You know, it's not like installing, you know, I don't know, a mainframe product or something. It's within the capability of anyone who's installed Oracle, in my opinion. We've got a Toad party on Tuesday. Feel free to come along, 6:30. It's at the Tonga Room at the Fairmont Hotel, which has nothing to do with pirates or treasure, but that's the best picture I could find. There'll be books being given away and, you know, free food and drink and so forth. And that's it. Don't forget where you can reach me, and don't forget about Toad World. I think we've got like maybe 5 minutes at the most for questions. Has anyone got any questions? If not, thanks very much. Hope you have a great conference. Thanks for coming.